passion. This is all in for the love of the game. This is Love Set Match.
I mean, Andre Agassi had this goal. You don't have to be better than everyone else in the draw when you go out on the court. Like, you have to be better than someone that's across the net.
I think you got to stay active in a sport sense, you know, go out there, do some sports. I think it always makes you feel better, maybe more tired in the very moment, but actually the rest of the day feels better. And then I think giving back as well, you know, making other people happy is going to give you a good feeling too.
Hello and welcome to Tennis Pal Chronicles, the podcast to feed your passion for all things tennis. I am your host, Philip Kim, also known as Coach PK, the tennis pro for the Langham Huntington Hotel in sunny Southern California, and executive director for the nonprofit Love Set Match. I know what you're thinking. Wow, crazy PK is uploading yet another podcast so soon. Well, I'm excited to share the US Open interview that we just did. And you've got to do it when the time is right, and the US Open is happening right now. So we're delivering it for you. As you know, Tennis Pal Chronicles is sponsored by Tennis Pal, the best app to find cool people to play tennis with. So visit tennispal.com to download the app today. If you'd like to support the podcast and the mission of our nonprofit, Love Set Match, you can donate a tax-deductible donation two ways. First, you can Zelle us directly using the email aces@lovesetmatch.net. And second, you can donate on our Facebook page. Just go to facebook.com/lovesetmatch.org. Your contributions make what we do possible. So thank you so much. I am so excited to share our second interview with tennis journalist from London. You know him from our last Wimbledon review podcast, as we bring you up to speed on the US Open currently underway in New York. You're probably seeing all the pictures on social media and watching the YouTube highlight videos. Well, Martin Keady writes about tennis, including tennis history, for Last Word on Tennis, or LWOT for short. He's based in London, and his work can be found by searching Martin Keady under the author section on LWOT. Or you can follow him on X at MRTNKEADY or on his website, theshakespeareplays.com. So please welcome back Martin Keady to the Tennis Pal Chronicles. Martin, welcome back to the podcast. We're so happy to have you. We've got a lot of great response from people when you talked about Wimbledon with me, and really a lot of people saying you were so insightful, your comments were so enlightened. I especially love the idea of what you said, that Carlos is one of the fastest learners in the game. So lots of insight. We're looking forward to talking to you again. Tell me how you're doing and where you are now.
First of all, Philip, thank you very much again for having me on, and thank you for your kind words. I'm at home in London viewing the US Open from afar, the reverse for you of Wimbledon. So I'm learning the difficulties of time zone tennis, for want of a better term. You just lose track of time and which day it is, sure, trying to keep up with it all.
Yes, exactly. The worst for us is Australian Open. I think it's like 2 to 3 in the morning or 4 in the morning or something.
Australia's not too bad for us. It's the US Open is the worst. And we're very grateful on this side of the Atlantic that the finals next weekend, the men's and women's singles finals, are scheduled such that we can watch them before it's too late. So a global audience for a truly global event.
They say it's one of the biggest sporting events in the US, that we have over 800,000 people in attendance. The Super Bowl, by contrast, is about 500,000. And mostly it's because of the long duration, right? So many people are visiting over so many days.
Yeah.
So it just says that tennis is alive and well in United States and globally. It's a growing sport, and just super happy to be covering it with you.
Thank you. And I will just add as well, I'm sure part of it, as for many live events of any kind, sporting, artistic, whatever, I think there's been a big general bounce back after the pandemic, if I dare put it like that, because we weren't allowed to go along and watch live events for so long. We realised what we were missing. And I think most importantly, I think the performers realised what they were missing. I'm sure it was the same in American sports, playing in front of empty stadiums. It was better than there being no sport at all, but it wasn't really, quote, live sport. So I'm sure that's part of the reason that, as in New York, crowds at all the Grand Slams, I believe, are up. And that is obviously great.
Yes, and I'm sure so many people are enjoying their time at the U.S. Open. We're coming into the first weekend of it for 2023. What's your take so far? How have you been enjoying the action?
Well, with the caveat, as I said, of losing track of time because it's happening in a different time zone.
Right.
It's still been fantastic. I mean, we true net heads love the whole 2 weeks of a major, not just the final weekend, the wonderful matches that you see. I believe one is going on right now with Mukova and Taylor Townsend, which I'd love to see. A real contrast of styles, but two graceful players. So the main take last weekend, the main take post Cincinnati, that we're all hoping and expecting Carlitos v Novak 5, the fifth match that they've played, only the fifth match that they played, will be the final next weekend. We had the same at Wimbledon, where everyone was saying, no, there'll be hiccups, they probably won't make it. And of course, those caveats still apply, but in all likelihood, and in all hope and expectation, it will be Carlitos v Novak 5 next Sunday.
Yeah. What about Medvedev, the dark horse? He's still in the running. He's playing great.
And of course, hardcore is his best surface. And he excelled 2 years ago when he beat Novak in the final to deny Novak the calendar slam, i.e. the actual grand slam of winning all four majors in 1 year. He has a chance, Jannik Sinner has a chance, but the bad news for Medvedev and Sinner and everyone else is that hard court is also the favourite surface probably of both Novak and Carlitos. So it really is hard to see beyond them.
Yeah. How did you, let's jump back a little bit, how did you feel about Novak beating Carlos in their last match? That was pretty epic and right to the edge, right? Tiebreak.
It was an extraordinary match. And as I say, we've only had four matches between the two of them over the last 18 months. Three of them have been absolute classics. And the other one, which was the French Open semi-final where Alcaraz started cramping, even that was memorable in its own right. I believe that the Cincinnati final was the longest ever ATP Masters final over three sets. In the past, obviously, they would have had five set finals that were longer, but this was extraordinary. And I suppose for the benefit of the rivalry, it was quite good that Novak won in such extraordinary fashion after looking like he was going to collapse in the second set. But as is often said, Novak is either consciously or otherwise better at playing possum than any Antipodean marsupial. it was a fantastic match. And at the moment, it is exactly what tennis needed after the big three, that we now have a new big two players, albeit at very different stages of their career, but who are pushing each other to the absolute best. And I'll just say one other thing about Cincinnati, if I may, which was, I'm sure like many other people, I was very struck that Alcaraz was reduced to tears at the end. And that again showed what a supreme competitor he was. He's used to winning those epic matches where he finally, after 4 or 5 hours, beats his opponent. But it will probably do him good to have lost one, renewed his appetite. And I can't wait if they meet. Obviously, it's a big if. Federer and Nadal never met in New York, despite all the hopes that they would. If they meet, it should be fantastic, especially because it will be over five sets again.
Yes. Yeah. I think it's going to be another epic. And it's so interesting, as you say, the contrasting stories, Djokovic towards the end of his career, not quite, but definitely long in the tooth, and Carlos with miles and miles to go, right?
Well, hopefully we've seen again the specter of injury this week with poor Berrettini suffering what looked like another serious injury. And of course, being back in New York and unfortunately seeing him also have to withdraw in the second round, there's the memory of Dominic Thiem as well, who in a parallel tennis universe might be the dominant player in the world now, were it not for the injuries he'd suffered. I think I've said to you before, Philip, that I'm more of a narrative than a numbers person, partly because of my age. But I discovered through a tennis friend an amazing statistic the other day, which I'll just quote briefly, if I may. Apparently in 2019 to 20, so those two seasons, Dominic Thiem had an overwhelming winning record against the big three of Federer, Djokovic and Nadal. It was something like 9-3, which is remarkable, and it's easy to forget that. And that's why, obviously, we hope all players have long careers. We hope a player as great as Alcaraz has an exceptionally long career, but you never know for certain. It's a bad pun, I suppose, the Achilles heel of sport. It's the greatest thing to do in the world, but there is always that danger that your career could end at any moment.
Yeah, tennis is a harsh mistress. That is true. It brings to mind Rune, who has been on a losing streak, and everybody thought he was like the next prince, you know, arising. You know, questions about his fitness and his health and what's happening there, but obviously a very talented player and so enjoyable to watch.
I agree. I wrote a piece for Last Word on Tennis earlier this year saying that this was before the French Open, actually, that Rune now needed to add the stamina to go with all his natural ability. Again, Alcaraz is...
And his swagger.
Well, and his swagger, which we all publicly profess to dislike, but secretly love. It's true.
Wish it could be us.
It is fascinating. It's wonderful to have the contrast. I've said in the past that Alcaraz v. Alcaraz Rune, if that develops as a rivalry, is, you know, it's a new Borg-McEnroe rivalry in terms of temperament, really. But yes, it was... Rune, it seems, needs to take a break. He's been playing very, you know, an enormous amount of tennis at a very young age. And as we see, certainly in other sports, I mainly follow football, soccer as well. If you start young, the danger is that you'll finish young as well. So hopefully that won't be the case with Rune. He is a phenomenal talent, and we really hope that we can see him up against Alcaraz and others in the majors for years to come.
Yeah, and getting back to Djokovic, I have to think, even though he has been champion many times at the U.S. Open, he's also had some pretty negative publicity as well as feedback from the crowds there. Obviously, the accident where he hit someone with the ball. You know, I just wonder what his feeling is going into the U.S. Open. How does he feel about it? I would think that he's a little bit more hesitant than at other slams.
It's possible, of course. I think it was 2020 when he last... No, 2021. It was 2020 when he defaulted. 2021, he had the very strange experience. I think it's been largely forgotten, but when he was losing at the end of the final in 2021, for the first time really at any major ever, there was this enormous feeling of support and real love for him, which he hadn't enjoyed, certainly in comparison to Federer and Nadal. And he said afterwards, even though he'd lost the match, that had meant the world to him. And then, of course, within 6 months of that, he had there was all the furore over the vaccine, etc., which we don't need to revisit now. He's back in America. By definition, it's more unfamiliar to him than the other majors because he hasn't played there for so long. But he will have fabulous memories of having won there in the past. And as we all know, if there's one thing he likes, it's a challenge. He overcame arguably the greatest challenge in sporting history, not just tennis history, to overcome the Federer-Nadal duopoly and surpass them both, at least in terms of majors. So facing up to Alcaraz as the defending champion and facing up to a possibly hostile crowd, in many ways, I think he will feed upon that.
Interesting, yeah. Well, it's sad to see a couple of early exits. We were surprised by Tsitsipas losing quickly. And I don't know if you had a chance to watch the Dominic Strickler match, but very interesting to see him go out. Of course, maybe hardcourt isn't his favorite surface.
No, hardcourt isn't, certainly isn't. I mean, he has a generally poor record in New York, I believe. I don't think he's been beyond the third round, which for a player of his obvious calibre is very surprising. He's done well in Australia, reaching the semi-final in the past, so it's clearly not just hardcourt per se, but I suppose one thing to bear in mind about the US Open is that it is the final major of the season and you come into it tired, by definition more tired than you have been throughout, you know, before any other major. And I remember from my own memories of visiting New York, the capital of the world, that when you're on a roll there, you are unstoppable, as Alcaraz proved last year, for example. But the reverse can be true. You can get stuck into a cycle of negativity. It's too noisy. It's not clay, whatever. I fear more generally that Tsitsipas is facing the career dilemma of most players his age, notably Andrei Rublev as well, that, you know, they waited so long for the big three finally to end. And then here comes another dominant player, it seems, in the form of Alcaraz. I know that Tsitsipas has gone back to his coach, Mark Philippoussis, who he had split with. He went back to him, but unfortunately the results haven't worked out immediately. If Philippoussis can improve his serve, especially his second serve, then he can come back and really challenge again next year. But that's obviously a big if.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah, it was so surprising to see him go out so quickly. Although, as you said, it's not his favorite surface. But interesting to see what will happen in the next year, working again with Philippoussis, who was a lot of fun to watch, and what a server he is.
Oh, one of the greatest. And, of course, like most servers, was beset by injury problems, especially shoulder problems. But it's great to have him working as a coach. I mean, my goodness, it's probably happened already, but if it happens again in the past where Tsitsipas plays Djokovic, then you'll have Ivan Isovic coaching Djokovic and Philippoussis coaching Tsitsipas, and it, you know, two of the greatest servers ever. I mean, paradoxically, their charges, both Djokovic and Tsitsipas, neither of them are on the surface great servers. I mean, Novak obviously is a truly great server, a deceptively good one. Right. But even he wouldn't have fired down the number of aces that even Isovic and Philippoussis did at their peak. They were both phenomenal servers.
Well, I guess speaking of servers, we have to talk about John Isner and the end of his career. As an American, he was someone that we all looked up to, especially because he had the college path, which was very unusual. And it kind of gave a boost to people, him and Stevie Johnson, you know, just the idea of going to college and then playing tennis and the benefit of college tennis as well. But what an amazing server. The record for aces, incredible.
Absolutely. Before I talk about John Isner in particular, I will just say, it's almost surprising for me to hear you say that about the college route in America, because I can assure you in England in particular, in Britain in particular, the reverse is completely true. I mean, so many of our top players have gone through the US college system, Cam Norrie, Lily Miyazaki, who got to the second round earlier. And for them, it's absolutely extraordinary. I know that in America, college sports, especially basketball and American football are enormously popular, but all of them draw huge crowds. There was the 90,000 to see the women's volleyball match I read about earlier this week. That's absolutely inconceivable anywhere outside of the United States for a college sport, for a university event. So as for Isner himself, I always remember that the great John McEnroe, when in one of those sort of tennis quizzes things that we netheads love so much, you know, build your perfect player, he chose John Isner's serve for the serve of the perfect player on the basis that he'd served 50,000 aces or whatever it was. I mean, it's as Asimov said, the human mind can't count that high. You get to 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then you say just a lot. And he served a lot of aces. And what is really interesting about John Isner, obviously he's had an excellent career and, you know, has... In his case, I believe he has 4 children, so the millions that he has made will obviously come in handy, and he has deserved them. But I remember writing about this a few years ago. John Isner is not one of the greats of tennis when you measure him against a Borg or a Federer or a McEnroe. But unlike those, he has a historic note in that he literally changed tennis. His two epic matches at Wimbledon, in first against Nicola Mahu in 2010, it was a first round match and it took 4 days. It finished the final set, which I always have to remind myself, it finished 70-68. Fast forward 8 years, and in the semi-final against Kevin Anderson, it was the longest ever semi-final that went to 26-24 in the fifth set. And as a result of those two matches in particular, it galvanised change, especially at Wimbledon, to bring in tie breaks, even in the fifth set, because it was clearly impossible for that to be sustained in the future. So John Isner...
wasn't it over 3 days or two,
I believe it was 4 days. It began on a Monday and it finally finished on a Thursday. And it is still... I don't fully understand the game, but I am a fan of American football. And I know that American football coaches cite it as a touchstone of endurance. That they, yes, you know... 70-68 in the fifth set, and I think at least two of the 4 previous sets went to tiebreakers. You know, it was an enormously long match, and it was also a classic sporting contest. Both men knew that whoever won was not going to win their next match. They were just absolutely determined to win that match, whatever it took. So that's what I always think about. In addition to his enormous serve and great serve, when I think of John Isner.
Yeah, and I always think it's amazing in the stats of greatest servers that it's John Isner who's 7 feet, or they say 6'11", and then Ivo Karlovic, Dr. Evil, and then Roger Federer, which is amazing because he doesn't really have a bomb 140-mile-an-hour serve, and yet one of the best spot servers, over 10,000 aces in his career, is just insane.
Well, that's the second great stat I've heard this week to go along with the one about Dominic Thiem earlier. And it is remarkable and it seems counterintuitive. All I would say is that Roger Federer, at his best, was a truly extraordinary server. Speed and in particular placement, and with him it wasn't just the speed of the serve but the speed with which the serves kept coming. I'm sure all Fed heads remember many service games where he would serve 4 aces, often with first serves, and they seemed to be the game seemed to be complete within 45 seconds. So on that basis, I suppose it would make sense. He was a great server, and I was lucky enough to see him live once, and it was even better than I'd hoped, because what was extraordinary...
Was that at Wimbledon?
That was actually the O2 finals, the end-of-tour finals, which were held at the O2 until recently. They've obviously now moved to Turin for the next few years. I saw him play another American, Jack Sock, and it was wonderful. And what was incredible, as I kept saying to people afterwards... Most people have to slow down to do things well. A select few speed up to do them well. So Roger Federer is the classic example in tennis that he could play so well so quickly And that was never truer than of his serve.
Yeah, incredible record. And I would say also the talent of his serve, because he would throw in just random spins, random out wide. And it wasn't very predictable. And I think that's what made it one of the best.
Oh, absolutely. Infinite variety from an infinitely talented player.
Yes. Well, let's throw it back to your side of the pond. And sad to say that Andy Murray was knocked out of the US Open. How did the Brits take that?
Well, in good grace, Andy Murray is an all-time sporting great, an all-time tennis great. Another great stat or historical footnote. Actually, it's not a footnote. It should be a top note. In years to come, it will be asked who was the only other player who got to world number one in the era of the big three. And it was Murray.
Yes.
Stan Wawrinka has the same number of majors as him, three, and actually from three different majors as opposed to two for Andy. But it was the fact that he got to number one in that era, historically the most competitive there has ever been, that is remarkable. And so he is undoubtedly on the downward slope. In his case, it's been a long and slow and steep one, if that's not defying the laws of physics. His injuries have, you know, what's remarkable, his career almost divides into two halves. The first half culminating in the second Wimbledon title and the second Olympic gold in 2016.
He robbed Roger Federer. He robbed him of that Olympic gold.
Well, quite. And that, which of course was his breakthrough in 2012. Yeah. It was winning Wimbledon in inverted commas at the Olympic event that allowed him to win Wimbledon proper the following year. But unfortunately, after 2016, he suffered such a succession of injuries that it's, you know, he clearly can never be the player that he was. But arguably, the second half of his career is even more admirable than the first. It's easy to keep going when everything's going well, when you're ascending. To keep going when you're plateauing at best is incredible. Whenever he retires, he knows that he will have done everything possible to prolong his career. And that's all that any athlete could ask.
Yeah, the fight and the heart of Andy Murray is just astounding to see him fighting for every point. I actually got to see him play a practice set at Indian Wells against Jack Draper. And even in the practice set, on the practice courts at Indian Wells, he was mouthing off, talking to himself, arguing about points with Jack Draper. he is a competitive machine, that man.
he's very voluble and very vocal, and he absolutely, you know, wears his heart on his sleeve, to quote Shakespeare. A British commentator, BBC commentator David Law, was saying that with him, he doesn't hide anything. It all comes out, and it always has come out. And
which is so un-British, isn't it?
Well,
not to be stereotypical.
Well, no. The irony is that, like so much of the world, that old British stereotype of the stiff upper lip, as it were, just to digress from tennis briefly, it really ended quite a long time ago with the death of Princess Diana. I mean, in retrospect, it can be seen that thereafter, I am not a royalist. Anyone who knows me knows that. But she was an admirable supporter of many charities, and she certainly encouraged. She was a very open person, and people responded to that, and that almost became her legacy. We're drifting away from tennis, but just to cut it short, British people are now much more. All peoples have changed and will change and should change. But you know, in that vein, British people are much more open and emotional and openly emotional than they may have been in the past. And Andy Murray is the perfect example.
Interesting.
Of that.
Thank you for educating me and our audience about the British public. I love that. Well, on that same line, Andy Murray's compatriots, Cam Norrie doing well, Katie Boulder and Jack Draper, as we mentioned, they're still in
yes.
it.
Yes.
Oh, and Dan Evans.
Absolutely. And all this without the champion of 2 years ago, Emma Raducanu, who hopefully will come back next year.
Oh, so sad.
It's It's you know, as a British tennis fan, it's wonderful. I think in the Open era, there have only ever been three British winners. It was Raducanu, Murray, and then Virginia Wade back in the morning before the day. And, you know, so there isn't, that's probably quite good for non-American, you know, competitors. But generally, and certainly since Andy won it in 2012, there hasn't been a great record. This week is encouraging just because these players are either rediscovering form, in the case of Dan Evans, who is clearly a talented player. Anyone who Roger Federer singles out as a hitting partner, you know, must be a player of talent. They're either rediscovering form like Evans, or in Katie Bolter's case and Jack Draper's case, they're really progressing. Jack Draper in particular is a great potential talent.
Such a talent.
He is struggling.
Yeah.
He is struggling with injuries. But I'll just again mention this briefly. I was on holiday in Italy and delighted to find that the Italians are truly obsessed with tennis. I found a tennis channel that was seemingly 24 hours a day.
Nice.
And on one of it, I would have seen one of those ATP quiz things with the top players. And they were asking a variety of questions, including the tennis quiz thing of build the perfect player, or who's the best current player, who has the best backhand, who has the best slice, etc. And obviously, the overwhelming number of answers were Djokovic or Alcaraz or other top players like Tsitsipas and Rublev. And the name that kept cropping up other than them wasn't Jannik Sinner, even though we were in Italy. It was actually Jack Draper. He was cited as having potentially one of the best serves. He's a left-hander, which a big left-handed serve is really difficult to deal with for most players.
A.K.A. Rafa.
You are so... Exactly. And he wasn't even left-handed, of course. The genius of...
Uncle Tony, to
create the only man with two forehands, Dr. Nadelstein's monster. He was an incredible player. And Jack, I'm not comparing Jack to Rafa, obviously not at the moment, but he has huge potential, especially on the serve. And it was really, it is really encouraging. Hubert Hurkacz is a very fine player, former Wimbledon semi-finalist 2 years ago. The man who bageled Roger Federer at Wimbledon, lest we forget, a fine player. And despite all his injury worries, Jack Draper got past him. So, and I will just add also that it is very encouraging to see Katie Bolter doing so well, and that's encouraging for the Great Britain's Billie Jean Cup team, who play a vital playoff. I know we're in the middle of the US Open, but they do play a vital playoff against Sweden in November. So hopefully Katie Bolter and Jody Burridge, who also won her first round match, which was a fine achievement, hopefully they'll be fit to play for the team.
Jack Draper really reminds me of an American. I mean, not only like his dashing good looks, where he looks like Captain America, Steve Rogers, you know, he just has that chiseled jaw, but also his play style is, you know, big serve, big forehand, you know, plus one. It really feels American in nature. Very interesting.
Well, it does. I mean, Andy Roddick at his best was one of the finest exponents of that. John Isner, to a lesser extent, you can see a sort of through line to Jack Draper. In addition to his good looks, I could easily see him being a TV or movie star in the future, because his other passion apparently is crime fiction and non-fiction, and he always says he would be a detective if he hadn't been a tennis
Sam
player.
Sam Spade in the making.
A 21st century version, just in time for the 100th anniversary of all those great noir novels of LA.
Well, just jumping back to Andy, it's sad to see him go, but watching him play against Grigor Dimitrov, who maybe also has found some form, felt like retro tennis. I mean, it really felt like 10 years ago.
Well, it was very interesting. One of my best friends, tennis friends, is a big fan of Dimitrov. He's a glorious player to watch. He has played some of the finest volleys in particular that I've ever seen. The one against Molchan to effectively win the match in the first round was incredible. I remember one at Indian Wells it must have been in 2021, I believe, that was a full body lunge stretch that I still think is the most incredible single volley I've ever seen in my life. He's a wonderful player, and it's great to see him. You know, no one thinks he's going to win slams anymore, but he's had an exceptional career. ATP Tour Finals winner, ranked at 3 in the world, again in the most competitive era ever. He reached the semi-finals 4 years ago in New York. It's not impossible that he could go on a run up until he meets, you know, Djokovic or Alcaraz, and there it would end, I'm sure.
Yes, yeah, I think so. He's been the man of the greatest potential since he started. Everybody used to call him Baby Fed, and he hated that, but his style was very similar, it seemed.
Well, the irony was that, again, it's all... I always remember Tim Henman saying... People would say I'm a failure because I didn't win Wimbledon. He said, but I got to number 4 in the world. And he would always, are you the 4th best lawyer in the world? Are you the 4th best teacher in the world? He was. To be in the top 10 in the world, I think, is a huge achievement in and of itself. Yeah. So, and Gregor, you know, he got to number 3 in the world in this supremely competitive era. And just one, I'm a great lover of tennis history as well, not just the Open era, but going further back. And so I was just thinking that I wonder if Grigor might have not a full laugh, but a last little laugh in a way, in that he was the man in a way who really, in many ways, ended Federer's career when he beat him in the quarterfinals at the US Open in 2019. You know, Federer was injured. It was a dreadful performance. And, you know, but Roger Federer was never the same again afterwards. He limped on to Australia and then the long run of injuries. And it just occurred to me that if, as Andy Murray himself has said, that, that very debilitating loss to Dimitrov, if that does really end any hope he has of making a deep run, then it's as if Grigor Dimitrov is a legend killer again. He's the man who finally ends the careers of these great players, which... Again, just a little historical footnote, and I hope in Andy's case it's not yet going to happen.
Yeah, well, hopefully you haven't ignited all Federer fans against Dimitrov in that short story, because it would be, the wrath would be fierce. I mean, he's a winner in my book. Anyone who has dated Serena and Sharapova is a true champion.
Well, that's another matter. I wondered if it would be possible, just even if only briefly, Philip, to talk about the women's side.
I was just going to ask you. Yes, I'm very excited. Terrific. About the women's Good. Side, and I'm excited that you're interested, because last time we only talked about the men's side.
Well, That was regrettable in one sense, but also inevitable given the extraordinary Wimbledon final between the men's singles final between Alcaraz and Djokovic. That final demanded complete and exclusive attention. On the women's side in New York this week, it's fascinating because there are far more genuine contenders on the women's side than the men's. I mean, it is hard to look beyond two in the men's, but beyond what were emerging as the big three on the women's side of Iga Swiatek, Arina Sabalenka and Elena Rybakina, there are at least two or three other really viable candidates. Vondrousova has won a title now, and hard court's not really her surface, but once you've won one major, it is absolutely by definition easier to win another. And then you also have the two Americans who are doing so well and did so well before the US Open. It's wonderful to see them really fulfilling their talents.
Well, you
now.
Know the USTA wants Coco Gauff to win, that's for sure.
Well, Jessica Pegula, it's interesting that they play doubles, Jessica Pegula and Coco Gauff, because in so many ways they are very different people with very different backgrounds and backstories, but they are both, as any top 10 or top 50 or even top 100, probably top 1,000 tennis player, they're all incredible hard workers. And this summer, they both won Masters for Coco. WTA 1000 events, forgive my slip of the tongue. Coco winning in Cincinnati, which was a great achievement, beating Iga for the first time en route to that title, and Jessica winning what I believe was her second WTA 1000 event in Montreal the week before. So they must be brimming with confidence. And as I say, there are, and of course, it looks really unlikely given the physical problems she's had this week. There is always the wonderful, the unique Ange Jabeur. You know, she was a runner-up last year. She has clearly been suffering in the heat and humidity earlier in the week, and I gather it's going to be a very, very hot and sticky Labor Day weekend. So it might be that the conditions prevent her playing at her best there. But the women's side is absolutely compelling too.
Yeah, I love Rybakina. She's my favorite player, and I love watching her play. I often send videos of her to my students saying, watch her form. She's just insane. And of course, Sabalenka, who when she first came on, I was just in awe of how hard she hit the ball. Just incredible. And it was it was a big change during
incredible.
That time. I felt like there were like four or five young girls who all of a sudden came up and were hitting Yastremska, also Sabalenka. There were so many great players that were just hitting the ball so incredibly hard. It was really exciting to see. So I'm always thinking Iga, Swiatek, Sabalenka, Rybakina. That's the top three in my head.
Well, it is, you know, and it probably is in the world rankings now as well. And in recent major wins, and the others are outsiders by comparison, but they have, you know, Coco in particular has really upped her game. The presence of Brad Gilbert is fascinating. You know, the original, if he didn't coin the term winning ugly, it was certainly the title of his great coaching book. And he seems to be, you know, whatever he's doing seems to be working so far.
Well,
so
Coco to beat Iga, what a huge, huge win that was, because Iga was giving her a drubbing every time they played. It didn't even look like a contest. So can you imagine how that felt for Coco's mindset? Wow.
Well, it must have been, I mean, it must have been wonderful. It, you know, I believe she'd lost the previous six matches without even winning a set,
right,
which for a player of her ability is very surprising. But Iga Swiatek is an incredible player. Her backhand, I've never seen a sort of more fluid, easy-looking backhand. I mean, even two-handed, that is. It's remarkable. I mean, it's very, she, Rafa Nadal is her hero, and she's very Nadal-like in, at her best, appearing to have two forehands. She's so good on both sides. And just going back briefly to Rybakina, I'm a huge fan too, Philip, and I imagine when you say you send out clips of her to your students, I would imagine you would also, you'd include quite a few about her serve. I think she has the best serve in the women's game. Obviously, height helps, but in addition, she clearly has marvellous timing. And as you say, with Aryna Sabalenka in particular, the hitting power is remarkable. And it probably is overall, all tennis, all speeds in tennis will have increased over the decade just with human evolution. But I would agree with you, there are certainly more powerful female hitters now than there used to be. Sabalenka, even Rybakina. That's probably the legacy of Serena more than anyone else, because up until Serena came along, no one, not even Martina Navratilova, could quite hit the ball with such power.
Right.
And that we talk about the plus one shot. Serena was probably the absolute empress of that shot. So it is absolutely fascinating. On a parochial level, I hope Katie Bolter can make the fourth round. She plays an American, I believe, Peyton Stearns, who is ranked close to her. So that seems to be a totally 50-50 match. And I'm hugely looking forward to the second week in both men's and women's. And of course, the great thing is we have the weekend before we get there.
Yes. I was super excited to see Elena win so handily in her first match, a very clean win. And then I did see Sabalenka serve three double faults in her last match. And that, I think, is the Achilles heel for her, right? If she can get over, and she, her serve has improved a lot, but you can definitely see mentally that when she's under pressure, she has a very hard time keeping that ball in the box.
That's true, but that's true of every tennis player who ever lived, isn't it, really? I mean, it's just worth remembering that the great Rafael Nadal, when he was on the point of getting to the 21st major at the Australian Open last year, 2022, you know, breaking the three-way tie with himself and Roger and Novak, and he couldn't serve out at the end of the match. He then broke Medvedev next. But if the great Rafael Nadal feels the pressure, which he obviously did, every other human being is entitled to feel it as well. So you're right, though, about Sabalenka's serve. In a way, we were talking about, I was talking about, you know, the wonderful eternal game of constructing the perfect tennis player. If you had Rybakina's serve and Sabalenka's ground strokes, that would be a truly formidable player. But at the moment, neither Sabalenka's serve nor Rybakina's ground strokes are quite as good as their real, you know, their real strong points.
Yeah, I love Rybakina's strokes, though. I do feel like, compared to most other players except Sabalenka, she is hitting the ball so much harder and so much cleaner than most others. I mean, it was really exciting to see the Golden Retriever win just recently, but watching the speed of her balls coming back every time was just like, wow, the game has moved on. So it's just insane that she can keep up.
I remember it was probably about 2 years ago. It was at Eastbourne on the windy south coast of England, the traditional warm-up event for Wimbledon. And this would have been, so 2021, and it was the first time I really saw Rybakina, that I saw her over an extent, a whole match, and I just marvelled at the serve even then. I think she promptly lost in the first round or early on at Wimbledon in 2021, but then won it the following year. She has a great serve. I think in her case, she will be particularly motivated because she has won a major, but she didn't get the ranking points that would have come along with it. And I think that still rankles with her. A much worse example of that, of course, as we were discussing earlier, is poor Dominic Thiem, who won his only major without fans there. So, but going back to the women's side, it is absolutely fascinating. I wouldn't rule out Mukova either. I say that. I must check the score as soon as we finish talking in her match against Taylor Townsend. But if she gets through that, you know, she reached the French Open final. She's a wonderfully graceful, gifted player as well, and, you know, could easily be, a dark horse this coming 10 days.
Yeah, when I watch Mukova play, I often think of Roger Federer in her form, which is so strange because obviously they don't play at all alike. But for some reason, the form of which she hits the ball, the way that she rotates, it just reminds me of Roger.
Well, there is, you know, for most tennis players, even great tennis players, grace isn't always the first thing that springs to mind. It wouldn't be with Rafa and Novak, for example, which is the perpetual divide with Federer, who was the most graceful player ever. Ultimately, it both doesn't matter and is an argument that will never be resolved. All I ever say on the subject is that this subject goes on in every other sport and probably every other field of human activity. You know, who's the best nuclear physicist, etc., etc. But in sport, I always say that tennis is the game of aesthetes. It was the game that Fitzgerald wrote about and that Debussy wrote music about. And there's something really beautiful about tennis at its best. So it follows that aesthetics matter more in tennis than in any other sport. That's why we respond to players like Federer or Mukova or Caroline Garcia at her absolute best. By the way, I will just say I'm sure everyone heard over there, it was dreadful news for her. She had a dreadful first round performance, but apparently we learned today it was at least in part because she'd learned that her grandmother had died the day before. And one can't help but thinking it was admirable for her to have played, but she would have been better off just withdrawing, and no one would have possibly ever questioned her. I believe she had played at some extraordinary number of... Actually, no, that's Elise Cornet, who's played at an extraordinary number of consecutive slams, 65 or something. That wouldn't be the case with Garcia, but it was just a case of... It's obviously deeply sad for her anyway, so... But Garcia, at her best, is one of the most graceful players.
Yeah, I really
too.
Enjoy watching her play. She does seem more up and down than these other players, but yeah, really beautiful style. Enjoy that. And one of the great American hopefuls for us, Chris Eubanks, was really on a roll, and so sad to see him exit early, because you would think with the big serve that he has that he would be able to do well here.
Well, I didn't see that match, but I was reading afterwards. It'd be doubly unfortunate that he had to forfeit a game to go to the toilet or bathroom, which seems really, you know, low comedy, just very unfortunate for him. He was brilliant at Wimbledon. He is clearly a late bloomer, but a late bloomer with enormous potential. You know, there's, as it were, the natural replacement for John Isner in American tennis and perhaps even the Davis Cup team in time.
Yes, yes. And so fun to watch his kind of throwback style with the single-handed backhand, you know, just really fun. A lot of serve and volley coming to the net, exciting points.
I would just say briefly, if I may, Philip, that thankfully serve and volley is making a bit of a comeback, led by Carlos Alcaraz.
With the drop shots, yeah.
And also other players. For example, Coco Gauff has been wonderful at playing doubles while also playing singles, which has improved her net game. But Carlos Alcaraz has really brought the forecourt, the net, back into the game, and every other player... Novak already could do that, as proven by his 7 Wimbledon titles, but every other player now knows, I've got to learn to volley. I won't be able to beat him from the baseline. I've got to take him on in an all-court match, and I've got to improve volleying. Tsitsipas is a classic example. And again, hopefully he'll learn that under... Well, not learn it, but it will improve his volleying and feel more comfortable with it under Mark Philippoussis.
That makes me think of Ruud, because he unfortunately also went out early and just stays so far back behind the baseline, hardly ever comes to the net. And I just think more variety in his game is going to give him better chances.
Oh, undoubtedly. I think it's fascinating now. It may be that the long term... I mean, in the past, you had the great serve volleyers obviously you had the great Pete Sampras, who's probably the finest serve volleyer there ever was. However, now in the future, and this may be a lasting legacy of the big three, where you had three complete all-court players in Roger and Rafa and Novak, and now Carlos Alcaraz, Carlitos following them, you may have to be a complete all-court player. You can't just be a baseliner. I mean, there may be blips, but I suspect that's the long-term trend in men's tennis, that you will have to be an all-court player to beat Alcaraz, you know, to stop him winning the next 10, 15 after Novak retires.
Which, you know, also is going to spawn millions of new tennis players who are going to be all-court, which is great.
Oh, it's
on the recreational level as well as on the professional level. So everybody's going to be inspired by that, which we are excited. And I did want to also just remind the listeners about this really great stat. The person who beat Casper Ruud was the first Chinese man to actually beat a top 5 ATP player, Zhang Jian. So it was really cool to see. Finally, a Chinese male. You would think, with the population that they have, that they'd had a more formidable Chinese man come to the forefront. Obviously, on the women's side, they've been really competitive. So it's really exciting to see something new happening coming out of Asia.
Well, absolutely. He is a very fine player, and Casper Ruud seems to have momentarily lost his way. He's sort of facing the Alcaraz question that they all, I think he got to number 2 in the world last year, certainly very close, but at the moment you can't see him beating Alcaraz in a major final, so he'll probably have to regroup and reboot. Yes, I mean, China is obviously the most populous nation on earth, but thankfully, sport in particular, and perhaps tennis especially, if it was all down to population numbers, then America, Russia, China would have won all the titles. Thankfully, we have the Britons and the Australians and the Sweden, and of course,
Switzerland
and the Serbia and the Croatia. I'm a great lover of team events in tennis, and I love Davis Cup, and I often wonder why there isn't a real World Cup as in tennis.
Yeah,
that's another matter for another podcast. But
you must love the Laver Cup, then.
Not the Laver Cup, I'm afraid, because it's. I would love it if it were truly intercontinental, where all the continents competed. But otherwise, it's one of Roger's few missteps. It's a glorified exhibition to me, No, it is fascinating. These, you know, in 2023, it's almost the best of both worlds, really, for tennis fans, that you have got on the men's side, the most successful player ever, arguably the greatest player ever, Novak Djokovic. And you've got this new wunderkind, Carlos Alcaraz against him. In addition to the fabulous women's event, where there are three absolute genuine contenders and three or four other absolute contenders and real dark horses for the title. So it promises to be a spectacular second week. I just hope the weather doesn't play havoc too much.
Yes. Well, speaking of second week, I hope, Martin, that you will make some time and we can cover the U.S. Open once it's done. Look at all the fallout and all the champions that have won.
That would be my sincere pleasure, Philip.
It's been great talking to you about all of this stuff that's happening at the U.S. Open. I'm going to try to get this podcast out as soon as possible because, as we know in tennis, it just keeps moving on.
Oh, absolutely. I suspect Mukova has already gone out after I jinxed her. But it's a huge... I mean, I, like all netheads... Philip, there's nothing I like more. My wife used to have a dice for me. It applied to football, but it also applies to tennis, where it was play tennis, think about tennis, read about tennis, you know, all the six sides being related to tennis. So it's a great pleasure.
Great. Thank you so much for being a part of our podcast and adding so much insight into the game of tennis. Really enjoy all of the things that are flowing from your brain. It's truly impressive.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks very much. Great. Thanks for everything. And I really do look forward to next week. I mean, I love the majors. It's like Christmas four times a year. So only it lasts for 2 weeks instead of one day. So and of course, with the US Open, you know, it is the final one of the year. And I'll just say this briefly. This may not be for the podcast. As someone on the other side of the Atlantic, I've always had to listen to it late at night, listening on the radio, but there's nothing more intense or, you know, radio in particular, like with the podcast now, is such a... It really takes you there in a way that even television doesn't. You get the pictures, but you don't get the atmosphere. So I remember when Sampras won his final major over 21 years ago now. It was just incredible. So if I just hope... If it is Carlos Novak 5, as it will surely be billed in New York, it should be extraordinary.
And on that note, we're done. Thank you so much.
Bye for now, Philip, and we'll talk again soon.
Bye-bye. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Tennis Pal Coach has everything a coach needs to expand and generate business right in the palm of their hand. With Tennis Pal Coach, coaches can access the fastest growing community of tennis players on an app. They can analyze videos and communicate with students via text or video chat anywhere in the world. Coaches can also plan and schedule lessons, as well as receive payment. Tennis Pal Coach, because coaching doesn't have to stop off the court.